Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Messon.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Haggerty.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foolish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a guest lined up for you and two topics under discussion. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And John, this is our 494th show. So we're getting close to that magical 500 shows.
Wow.
And I think we've got to do something special for that one.
Yeah, we do it in the nude.
I don't think that's special, no. Actually, that sounded wrong, doesn't it? I think we're doing it in the nude anyway. No. I think if anyone's got any ideas what we should do, please drop us an email or put a comment on Facebook. We'd love to hear your thoughts, or maybe even a guest you'd like to hear from.
A guest would be nice. Something special.
Yeah. Well, our guest on this show is someone special, as they all are. It's Nick Kidd from the world of badminton, because he's just opened the Nick Kidd Badminton Arena here in Perth, a specialist badminton centre, 6 courts. It is a really fantastic facility. I've been there. And so we're just going to catch up with Nick and see if this was his dream when he set out on his path in badminton. And let's not forget, he was a kid who grew up in Mount Magnet, John. And
lovely town, Mount Magnet. Very happy memories, fond.
Long way from anywhere, though, isn't it? Let's just give our listeners that.
It's pretty close to Sandstone.
Yeah, but it's about 200 k's to the nearest major town. Headland?
No, Geraldton. It's about Mount Magnet's about 3 hours inland from the coast. From Geraldton.
Yeah, still a fair way.
There's lots of big holes in the ground. That's what Mount Magnet's famous for. And a hill. It's got one hill right in the middle of the town.
Anyway, should we get moving on our first topic?
Forget about the geography.
Look, the topic I wanted to talk about was, as we've seen, the A-League over here now, the owners have got their hands on the running of that, and they're changing. Well, they've said they're going to announce a new marketing campaign. I think that's going to be really interesting in itself, and we can probably discuss that when we know more about it. But as they try and pull people back in who've walked away from the game. But what they've also come up with is some other changes that they're saying that are going to basically, hopefully, make fans engage a bit more. Now, it's probably easier, John, if we go through some of those ideas that they've got. Now, one of the first ones in the list I've got here was that the wooden spooners in the A-League would be excluded from the following year's FFA Cup. Now, they're saying this would generate interest at the bottom of the table. I'm not sure it will, because to me, they're two separate competitions, and you're basically then damaging the integrity of the FFA Cup. That's my personal view.
I would agree with you.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the FFA Cup is damaged anyway, because they, you know, seed the A-League teams to play against each other, so, and they also make sure that a non-professional team always makes the semi-finals. I think it should be just a straight out-and-out cup competition like the FA Cup.
I would agree with you 100%.
Obviously, the league this year goes to 11 teams. And what they're saying is they hope the additional fixture will actually improve things. What they're also going to do is, where they had the Cup Winners Cup, which is similar to the FA Community Shield, they're going to change that, and it's now, it used to be contested between the A-League champions and the FFA Cup champions. They're now going to change it to the A-League champions, who will play the premiers, so the people that top the league at the end of the season.
What happens if that's the same team?
Yeah, well, then they'll probably have to pay the FFA Cup champions. Yeah, again, to me, is there a need to do that?
You know what? It's sort of like an all-star game. We see other sports with those sorts of, what would you call them? The security's in. Apologies if you hear anything in the background, folks, you're not expecting on a podcast. Like Chooks, for instance. Let's get back to where we were. You see other sports have their all-star game at the end of the season. So NFL does it, basketball has that sort of stuff. Maybe instead of having an all-star team, you do have that, you know, call it a fan game. You know, the A-League and the FA. Once again, you're stuck in the same position. The same team could win both. And especially if you're at the top of the A-League, there's a good chance you're going to be around the semi-finals or so of the FFA Cup.
Yeah, I just think it's a game that, does anybody really pay any attention to it? Do they really care? I mean, it's like, to be honest, the Community Shield in the UK. I think that's lost a lot of its sheen as a pre-season game, you know, between the league champions and the FA Cup champions. What I've said, but probably now the state of Scottish football, it wouldn't have as much interest. But I would have always liked to have seen it between the English champions and the Scottish champions, because I think people, then there's a bit of, oh, yes, it's Scotland, England. There's a little bit of rivalry. To me, that would have regenerated it. What could we do? Make the game? I don't know. It's very difficult down here. I just wonder whether you actually need that competition at all.
Yep, that's it's not a game that's going to mean much.
Yeah, it's not a game I rush home to watch either, I've got to be honest. Anyway, they're also going to revamp the final series. And what they're saying is there's the possibility of bringing back home and away ties within the finals, so that will capitalise on the significant hike in attendances and TV ratings that occurred during the final series. And they're also saying that they're going to share the revenue between the teams that are in the finals. Now, sharing the revenue, I think, is really good, because in the past the FFA has tended to take the money from the finals series. That, to me, is essential, has to happen. But I don't know whether the A-League is in a position where they can honestly afford the costs of playing home and away finals games.
Yeah, that would be the biggest, especially in a country like Australia, where as soon as you start talking home and away, you're talking airfares and accommodation. Now, not to say that in other countries they don't have to do that as well, but I would suggest in smaller nations, airfares are going to be smaller. I mean, say if it's Perth and Sydney playing in a home and away, that's a huge impost cost-wise on both teams to go each way. You know, I'm sure they can afford it in Premier League and the Bundesliga and all that sort of stuff. I'm not so sure that the Australian professional top-level soccer can support that at this stage. If they grow the game, who knows?
Yeah, I think that might be trying to run before you can walk. I would just keep it as it is for now and have that as a goal maybe in 3 or 4 years' time.
Remember, anything that they're talking about here, any improvements of what changes are all tempered by the fact that you've got to get... It's what the fans think. You know, the fans will be the ones that decide what works and what doesn't work. And until you can fully engage the Australian soccer fan to follow Australian soccer as opposed to
football,
follow...
Football, son. Football.
No, soccer. Well, that's another podcast. You're not going to have any success at all. I mean, Australian football fans are more interested in what's happening in England and what's happening in Spain and what's happening in Italy than they are interested in what's happening in their own country. And that's a sad fact.
Yeah, and I think linked to that is the interesting thing that they're talking as well about changing the championship toilet seat will remain, which is what you get for winning the final series. But they're saying the Premier's plate may change.
And they're going to put a hole in it.
And what they're saying is they're going to have another trophy that will maybe bring more prestige to winning the home and away season, which is actually going to what you're saying. Because there's only really two countries, I think, in the world where the final series is the champions, and that's the USA and Australia. Everywhere else, the team that wins the league is the champion. And maybe they're thinking along the lines that you're saying, that this will engage those fans who follow the English Premier League, the Spanish, Dutch, etc. Interesting. I don't know whether it'll make that much difference.
I am an unabashed fan of finals in any sport. I don't care what sport it is. I think that if after you play the league, you should have a final series. And I would suggest that any administrator and any marketer loves finals and should love finals wholeheartedly, hold them to the breast and cherish them, because they are cash cows and they are excitement cows and they're media drawing cows.
Yeah, I must admit, I've changed my tune. When I first came to Australia, didn't like them at all. I totally agree with the sentiments you just aired there. I think the only thing I disagree with is, to me, whoever wins the league is the champion in my book, because to win a home and away season, finish top of a league table after 20 games or, you know, however many games there are, takes a heck of a lot of doing, and it takes consistency of form and a depth of squad, etc. So to me, I always regard that team as the champion, And then, yeah, great if you win the finals, that's still pretty good. But to me, it's always the league winner that is the one who's the outstanding team.
I like the on-the-day factor that finals bring to a sporting competition, because that's when the pressure really comes on. You can waddle through a league and win every game and win every, you know,
if you waddle through, John, winning every game, it's pretty hard to do.
Our hockey team did last year, I'll tell you. We were playing in the wrong grade last year. What's interesting, though, we've gone up a grade and we're still at the top of the table.
But are you waddling still?
Oh, we waddle. Our teams are big on waddling. There's something about the cutthroat nature of those knockout-type finals that brings an extra element to, and shows up some teams as well. Some teams, when they get to finals, they can't really hack it because the pressure of having performed so well during a league suddenly bites them, and they, we lose this. And there's all sorts of mental games that go on with finals. I just love them.
But that's where, to me, you have something like knockout competitions. Like in England, they have the FFA Cup, yeah. FA Cup rather, and they have, you know, the same things in all the European leagues.
So, and I'm not,
to
I'm
me,
not
you have one or
change.
The other. But I do think there is a place for the finals.
I'm not advocating that those, they've been around for a long time and they're set in stone, and that's fine. But our Australian leagues are not hundreds of years old, 100 years old, or
correct,
anything like that. And this is where we can make changes and make improvements. And I would always be on the side of holding finals and making the grand finalists the champion of the year. They're the best team. You've got to perform to a certain level to get to finals. Now, some years there's teams that aren't very good that scrape in at the bottom end of the barrel and they're soon gone. But at the top end of it, the top two or three teams are always worthy, usually, of being the champions. Because there's so much luck involved.
Well, there is and there isn't. I mean, if you look at Zoran Matic in the old NSL, he, with Adelaide City, I think he won two, maybe three premierships. And the thing was, what he did was he got his teams to peak getting towards the end of the season. They got into the finals and then they won the finals. But they rarely were crowned the league champions, you know?
And that's what it's all about. It becomes the marathon. I mean, very often a team can play well early in a season and pick up some points and they'll finish one or two, but their last half of the season hasn't been particularly good at all. And you could argue that actually they're tapering down when they should be tapering up. They should be playing the most exciting game, you know?
Yeah. No, look, I can't argue with that. Now, the other thing that we... Well, no, I agree with you, but... The other thing that they're talking about as well is discussions are being held with the referees to talk about having them mic'd up. Now, personally, not a fan. I think sometimes it's okay, but what I find really sad, and if you talk to officials of the past, by being mic'd up, they cannot have the banter that they had with players, and it also makes it much harder for them to actually sometimes control a player, because where there is a familiarity between the officials and the players because they officiate them so often, and therefore they may know that, you know, John, you like to have a moan about certain things, and they'll just go, oi, John, stop your moaning, you know? Whereas if they're mic'd up, often, they can't word it the way they might word it if they weren't mic'd up. And so I think you lose a lot of that banter and communication between the players. And I'm not a fan of it. I think, yes, it's quite good when you get it on the rugby and you hear what the decision's for, because sometimes you can't see what it's for. It's good when you have it, certainly in hockey, when you have the video referral and you can actually hear what is being referred and what the video official is actually looking for. Again, because there could be confusion there, but I'm not a fan of it overall, to be honest.
Look, we had a situation just in the last 24 hours or so at the Euro Hockey Championships that are going on at the moment, where an umpire blew a free hit, the player had a whinge about it, and the umpire pulled out a card. Now, it turns out that the team who's got shown the card, you complained to the umpire, you know, oh, what's that for, rah, rah, rah. And the umpire basically said, well, I've got to give the card because this is on TV and I can't let that go. He's mic'd up. So his thought process was, other people outside of this arena have heard what you've just said, and while I can wash it off and deal with it, because that's been broadcast around the world, I'm going to have to give you a card now. Now, that could have easily been dealt with on the field without the need of a card. The umpire could turn around and said, mate, you say that again and you're in trouble. But because it's gone through the microphone system and everybody's heard what's said, bang, off you go, son. That's where I'm not liking that side of it.
Well, there's the famous rugby story, and it was England versus France in Paris, I think it was. Mike Burton playing for England, line out, one of the French players belted him, and he's down on the ground, and the referee's saying, are you okay? And he goes, yeah, I'll be okay. And the referee says, it was number four, you've got one free hit. Anyway, the game continues. Second half, line out, Mike Burton, so the story goes, belts the number four for France. And the French crowd, of course, want him sent off. It's a blatant kick. And the referee came up and was wagging his finger. He said, I told you I had one free hit. You've had it. Now, no more trouble. And that was the way that particular referee, so the myth says, handled that situation. But you're never going to get that. I mean, you're not going to get that now, because throwing punches in any sport is far more unacceptable now than it was back in the 60s.
Well, I just think that sport is about passion, and it's about impulse, and it's split seconds. And when everything's mic'd up, you start judging people in, you know, you're sitting back in the cold, hard reality of your lounge room or whatever it is, and you start judging people on you're just not judging.
Yeah, not
the right
judging them in the same situation, because
no,
they are in
right.
the cauldron of the game, as you say, and the passion and the adrenaline is pumping, yeah. And we're just like lying there, really cozy, relaxed. Yeah. And yeah, you can't judge it because you're not in that situation.
And okay, the umpires, generally, umpires are very accommodating. They understand that players are going for it, and you know they understand that players are going to swear sometimes, especially if you make a bad mistake. You know, you stuff something up, blah 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 blah. And they can draw a bit of a line there, or they can blur the lines is probably a better way. Okay, mate, you're a bit upset about it. Calm down. But as in that hockey case, once it gets out through that microphone, that's it. The umpire has no ability to really do anything except follow a prescribed line for a particular offence.
Yeah, man management goes out the window.
It does, totally. And I don't think that what goes on the field needs to be broadcast. We can see. We can tell when a bloke's going teeing off, just quietly. We don't need the microphone. And I just think there needs to be a little bit about the playing field that needs to be sacrosanct for the players and the officials. That's their cauldron.
Totally agree. It's like I don't agree with cameras in the dressing room. I think that is an absolute no-no. That is the one place that a player should have sanctuary.
And it's similar with the straight after the game post-match interviews, which, and how do you think you played today? I'd love one of these people, sports stars, come. Actually, I was complete shite. Wouldn't that be great? Comes off, goes, well, I had a dog of a game.
Hi, I'm Thomas the Hitman Hunt, and you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
Yes, you're indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and it's time for us to welcome our guest on the show. He's been on the show several times before, and is certainly a man who is passionate about his sport, and it's really good to hear that he's fulfilled a dream of his, which is to open a specialist badminton centre here in Perth. It's called the Nick Kidd Badminton Arena. It's in Balcatta, and our guest is Nick Kidd. Nick Kidd, welcome back to Knock the Footy Show.
Thank you very much, Ashley.
Well, it's good to be sitting now in the Nick Kidd Badminton Academy in Balcatta. Has this been a dream of yours to open your own centre?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, it's been a long time in the making. To be honest, I didn't think it would come to this, but it has, and it's actually a lot better than I dreamed that it would be. So here we are. I want to take you back, though, to when you first got introduced to badminton and you bought those... You were living in Marble Bar, I think it was, and went into Port Hedland, was it, and bought a badminton racket?
That's right, that's right. So we used to live in Marble Bar, and it was one of our grocery shopping trips. We used to travel 200 k's up to Port Hedland, and one of those trips we decided, or Mum and Dad decided that they would go in... visit one of the second-hand furniture places, and my sister and I were running around, you know, just as you do as kids, trying to find places, you know, to hide and all that sort of thing. And I sort of stumbled across this sort of bin of sports equipment, and yes, just happened to rummage through and found myself this old wooden-headed steel shaft framed racket, and I don't know what sort of drew me to it, but something did, and I, you know, I sort of took it to Dad, and I said, "Hey, Dad, you know, can I buy this?" And he was like, "Yeah, how much is it?" I think it was like 50 cents, and yeah, took it home. Unfortunately, couldn't use it because we didn't have any shuttles, but nevertheless, you know, we got shuttles a week or so later, and we got started playing in the garden. And, you know, it's from those sort of humble beginnings that it's come to this point now, you know. So,
I mean, it's an incredible story. Now you've got your own centre. I mean, obviously, three-time national champion as well, and, you know, been to Commonwealth Games. It must be a great journey when you look back in it. You must feel a sense of achievement now you've got this centre.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I suppose, you know, it was always, I mean, you never really think about ever having a badminton center when you're coming through as a player. But I mean, for me, like, it's been such a big part of my life. And it's given me such different opportunities, that, you know, to actually have my own badminton center, to be able to give back to the players, you know, of the future as well. It was, yeah, I don't know. It's just really, 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 really great. So,
I mean, the one thing I've watched you coaching young children playing and everything, and your passion really comes through. And I mean, is this again one of the things that now you can actually really focus on that coaching, as you say, and give back to not just those in certain areas where you were coaching before, but now to anybody?
Yeah, no, absolutely right, actually. I've just found, you know, the sport of badminton is no doubt about it's growing. And the thing here in Western Australia is, for it to grow, we need to be able to create, I think, clearer pathways. The pathways at the moment, I feel, for kids coming into the sport are not clear enough. They can get coaching, but it's sort of very sparse. So, you know, if I want a training on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and a Friday, and a Saturday, I can't just have it in one location. I've got to, you know, maybe go and train at, you know, a hired space, a rented space that the association, badminton associations, maybe have hired. And it could be in, you know, State Netball Centre. And then it could be suddenly that, okay, a Tuesday's training session is in Sampson. And then the training session for the Wednesday may be in Kingsway. And then the next session may be in Murdoch University. And the next one's in Curtin. So, you know, as a parent, it's a challenge. Like, these days especially, kids have got so much work. Parents have got so much work. So, you know, to be running around the countryside, to be able to give their kids the best opportunity, very much a challenge. So, for me, as someone looking in and, you know, someone that's passionate about my sport, I feel we always needed a space in our own centre. And so, you know, the arena was the dream. You know, so from this space, I want to be able to provide day-to-day training, you know, everyday training, whereby I can help players of all the different levels be able to get what they need, those essential ingredients to make badminton, make them better badminton players. Tournaments will be something that we're going to obviously look to do as well. And yeah, I just think it just needed that in order to make it much clearer and be able to pass on my knowledge in a way where they can use it and can use it consistently.
Are you going to make the facility available for schools? For example, if schools wanted to come and actually have a dedicated badminton session on a dedicated court where there are only badminton lines, you know,
are you going to give your time up if they wish to do that?
Most certainly, most certainly. I mean, at the moment, I work a lot in the schools, so that's what I do day to day. You know, that 9 till 3.30, 4 p.m. time slot. And for the schools, like, there is a lot of badminton happening in the schools, but definitely, I want to be able to provide this facility to the schools. What else I offer, I suppose, is, you know, my coaching, and I will have coaches that will be able to also provide coaching to whoever comes in. But the beautiful thing that I can also offer is we've got feeding machines. So we've got ball machines. So in tennis, they've got ball machines that keep serving that shuttle backwards and forwards. But the technology these days has allowed us to, or allowed them to create a machine that actually can send the shuttle consistently, a shuttlecock, consistently up into the sky or flat or fast or whatever it may be, over and over and over, and then you can create that repetition. Now, I've got five. So I can get that shuttle feeding machine to feed multiple kids on one court 100, 200 times in one, out of one machine. So for me, like, that's equivalent of, you know, one machine is equivalent of one knit kit.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, and you know, the funniest thing is that at the moment they've been named as Nick 1, Nick 2, Nick 3, Nick 4, Nick 5. So it's very nice of my students. But, you know, for me to be able to provide more badminton, that's why I thought I needed feeding machines. I needed to be able to provide more shuttles to the sky so that, you know, students of schools, students of my own academy can come, they can practice, they can get repetition, and that's the only way that I believe that you can start to really, really improve.
Absolutely. The only thing I would say that you need is some machine that picks them all up afterwards.
No, that's true. That's true. But that's where we have to employ, like, the younger kids to run around at the moment, right? That's how we... Classic, classic.
No, but you were also saying when you had the official opening, there were actually a few people from the sort of corporate world were saying they wouldn't mind you doing corporate evenings. So that's a whole new avenue.
Yeah, no, it was something that I didn't even, like, think about, didn't even enter into the mind. But, yeah, I mean, they really like the way that it came across, you know, the interaction with the machines, the, you know, the potential interaction with myself as a coach, and then just, you know, going and hiring one of the courts to be able to play badminton and create that team morale. I think that's what it was. And I did think about how to create something which could cater to corporates, whereby, you know, you can, because that's what they're doing a lot of the time at the moment. They're looking for things that can create that teamwork. And I think badminton is a fantastic sport for that. You know, it's not outside, so it's not like it's going to get affected by the weather. We're an indoor sport. You know, you hit a shuttlecock and you hit it slightly wrong or too hard, it doesn't go, you know, a couple of 20, 30, 40 meters away from you, like a potential, like a tennis ball. But yeah, any level can play it, and you can have fun with it. So, yeah, to bring those corporates together, we are definitely open to doing that. And, yeah, we'll see what happens.
I mean, looking at the facility, I would think there's been a lot of investment. I mean, it seems to me as all your years playing, you've taken all the good points of a lot of places and thought, if I'm going to do this, we need that, we need that, we need that. I mean, it's like, the courts are dedicated to badminton. It looks like you've got a cushioned floor as well. It's not just on concrete. So a lot of thought went into it, and I would think a lot of investment.
Yeah, no, most certainly. Yeah, a lot of money went into it, but in order for me to create what I felt was the perfect experience, you know, we needed to have lights that were lights that shone sideways, so entering into the court, rather than lights that hung from the roof and, you know, blinded you when you went to make that perfect smash chance, you know. The other thing that we did, obviously, is we invested in the Yonex, you know, Badminton World Federation approved green mats. So, you know, coming and playing here, you'd feel like you're nearly playing in the All England or something like that. obviously, on top of that, we needed to ensure that our students or any users had that the confidence that they can play on a court where, you know, then they're striking the ground and they're not having that impact go through their knees. So definitely, we invested in an underlay, a nice rubber underlay, which takes out a lot of that impact. So there's a nice absorption there, and the other thing that we've done is we obviously have painted the walls blue. So, you know, that white shuttlecock just stands out. There's no interference, makes it so easy to see. And, yeah, a lot of people just come in and they just go, wow. You know, I don't know how you felt when you walked in, Ashley, but I hope you sort of maybe felt a little bit that way.
I can assure you I did. Yeah, I was really, really impressed with it. And I'm not just saying that because we're sitting here, but it was great because you had one of the feeding machines on and just watching a young player just practice playing the same drop shot again and again. And as you say, repetition breeds, you know, muscle memory and all of that and consistency. And it was just great to see such a specialist center.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. It is a pleasure. You know, it was quite funny today, this morning, when I started coaching at 7. And one of the father that came in is like, oh, geez, it's so early. Like, Nick, do you get any sleep? Like, because I think I text him at close to 1 o'clock in the morning just to say, you know, that his daughter was on, see you in the morning. He's like, how do you do it? How do you even sleep? And even my student, she was like, do you sleep? What do you do? What do you drink? How do you do it? And I said, you know what? I feel so blessed. I feel blessed and I feel so lucky that I can, you know, do what I love every day, you know. Whether it be early morning or late at night, it's badminton, you know. I live and I breathe it. And I said, that's my tonic, honestly, you know. So she was like, oh, you're so lucky.
Well, you can see you're passionate. I mean, just finally, if people want to get in touch, you've got a website up now, and you can make bookings online, can't you, if they want to use the courts?
Yeah, most certainly. So nickkidbadmintonarena.com. They can jump on there. That will actually take them through to a potential online booking system. They can book the courts. It will show what's available and the costs. And then also off of there, they'll be able to see the site to be able to get badminton coaching, this online store. So we've got an online store that sells badminton products, which is predominantly Yonex products. And then, yeah, so easily accessible.
And you're not having membership. You're making it free to open to everybody. Not free, but open to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, we're open every, you know, any member I should call it the family of badminton. You know, anyone who loves badminton, is passionate about badminton, wants to come and play, definitely, it's open doors to them. Please, come and play. The only thing that I will definitely make a big point of is please make sure you wear the correct badminton shoes. We obviously spent a lot of money on courts, and, you know, the shoes themselves, some shoes actually leave big black marks, I'm very strict on that. I'm a little bit pedantic about people when they walk in and they have black shoes. I'm like, oh, okay, can you just show me that they don't mark? Because there's a lot of investment here. We want to make sure that we keep it looking good for, you know, further use for everyone.
Absolutely. Well, Nick, fantastic catching up with you again. It's a long journey from Marble Bar, but what a journey it's been, and congratulations. I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much, Ashley.
Hi, this is Ian Healy, and you're listening to This Is Not The Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not The Footy Show. And that was Nick Kidd. And as I mentioned, he's opened the Nick Kidd Badminton Arena in Balcatta. And he's also doing coaching. And I can tell you, John, he's working there long, long hours. In that when I caught up with him, he'd started a coaching that morning at 7 o'clock, finished at 11 o'clock at night. But boy, does he love what he's doing. He is so passionate about badminton.
And it's good to see. I mean, badminton too is a sport that's probably gaining in popularity around the world. And so it's big in Asia and, India, subcontinent. They love it. And us being here in Perth, it's tagging into that Asian market is a bloody good idea.
Well, the other thing I think that Nick's done that's, to me, really smart is you don't have to have a membership. So if you suddenly decided, oh, I want to have a game of badminton with someone, just go online, you book a court, and you can go and play there, which people, a lot of people today get upset when they have to buy a membership because they're going, well, I'll go away on holiday and then I'm not using it and it's so much a week and if I get sick. Whereas this way, he gets the money because you book the court and you pay for it online, and you get to play when it suits you. And to me, that's a win-win for everybody. As he said in that interview, though, the only thing he stipulates is your footwear, because he's invested a lot in those courts and he doesn't want black-soled shoes scuffing them up and making them, you know, not last the lifetime that they're meant to last.
Not the only sport that has footwear requirements for the surfaces they play on, so that's hardly onerous, I would have thought. But it's a great model for a sport like badminton. I mean, some sports that model wouldn't work, it just wouldn't function properly, but for a sport like badminton, that's great. That's a really good idea.
And the great thing is, as he said as well, he's looking to, maybe if you want a corporate event there, talk to him, and also if you've got schools that want to go in and have dedicated sessions with him. I mean, he's got six of those shuttlecock servers that flick the shuttlecock, so you can just basically practice and it goes in the same spot every time. And it's fantastic to watch. It's a really brilliant setup.
Well, you showed me some photos earlier, and it looks like, I mean, it's swish and flash and new, but it looks like a really good arena, you know. And
it's been well thought out, John,
by a
guy that's played at the top level. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's three times Australian champion. He's been to the Commonwealth Games. He knows what it's like to play at the top level, so he knows what is needed to make it be the best centre.
And it's that sort of clear thinking that often leads to success. And unfortunately, one area of sport where there's a lot of muddled thinking seems to be world rankings, Ashley.
Oh, yes.
Maybe you should get Nick onto organising world rankings systems, because it just throws my head, that stuff. I find it so hard across multiple sports, not just one sport, but across multiple sports. Do world rankings actually mean anything anymore?
My personal view is, I think in individual sports, yes, they do. So I think in sports like boxing and even badminton, where you need to determine who the top players are, and then you can seed them in a badminton situation into a tournament where everybody plays against everybody. And again, like Wimbledon, tennis is the same. You can seed your top players. Boxing, obviously, again, you've got who are the champions, who are those vying for a shot at the champion. It makes a lot of sense. But team sports, I'm with you. I actually don't see the need for it, because I was trying to check before we came on air today, and I think, and I stand corrected, but I think cricket now is the only team sport that I can think of where if you're number one at the end of a year, you get a trophy and a financial reward if you're number one in the test rankings. But I don't think there's another sport where you get that. And I mean, what's prompted this is obviously at the weekend with the rugby, we saw the All Blacks beat the Wallabies, which meant they went back to number one. And then later the same night, Wales beat England, so they then went to number one. But you go, but what does this matter? The World Cup's coming up in a month's time. Does this really matter?
Well, it's interesting in that rugby one. I would have thought New Zealand was so far ahead on results that one loss would not mean they were going to lose their world number one ranking. How can any other team be ranked above New Zealand in world rugby, given the results of the last 5 years? Yeah. How is anybody even close enough to think that they could pinch that top spot? That's what staggers me.
Yeah, and this is what I think everybody that is a sports fan looks at it and asks the same question, and they go, how could that be? And that's why I don't think these world ranking points in team games kind of, because maybe, and I haven't gone away and checked it, maybe Wales have played more games in the last year than the
All
Blacks.
That's right.
And that may well be the issue.
And that's one of the things that I struggle with in these world rankings that you see a lot of the time, is that teams lower down the rankings get less of an opportunity to accrue rankings points. They generally play in competitions where they're not given the same number of rankings points if they win it as other teams in different competitions, especially invitational tournaments. That just,
well,
or invitational
no
competitions.
That.
Yeah, that's right. Now that's the way football works, isn't it? You don't get points for friendlies.
No.
Yeah, and that's the way that, you know, I think is a good system. If you're going to have world rankings, it's only based upon official games that mean something, like World Cup qualifiers, and everybody has the same access to points as everybody else. As soon as one team has less access to gaining points than another team, it's a joke.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's where the system, but I still don't see the need for it in team sports. Now, I know football, for example, they do seed the top nations when it comes to the World Cup draw. And you've had, you know, your 32
your
teams
pots.
And the top ones go, yeah, and the pots, yeah. And they use it for that. And again, hockey does the same thing when it comes to the Olympic Games. The top ones get, again, preferential draw that they get seeded with that. So that you.
But those teams, they're playing in a competition where they have equal access to points, aren't they? I mean,
yeah.
That every team will play the same number of World Cup qualifiers and the same number of whatever qualifiers, you know, the Oceania or whatever, the Confederation. So they're all picking up points from the same pot,
yeah,
so to speak. Whereas in other sports, there's not the same access. So football can probably do a reasonably accurate world ranking. And get it probably close to right because of that equal access and everybody's on the same level playing field, whereas in other sports.
Well, yeah, I mean, we touched on rugby. Rugby doesn't have that. So, I mean, no. Are you trying to tell me that your Samoa, Tonga and Fiji get to play as many internationals a year as your England, Wales,
well,
Scotland?
Picking up games against the Western Force because they can't play those teams.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look, England, and I was astounded at this statistic, has not been to the Pacific Islands since the game turned professional. So since the game turned professional, England has not played a single test in the Pacific Islands.
Yeah, but they love taking the players, don't they?
Yeah, and you just go, well, no wonder they're struggling. And I mean, you know, I've got a bit of a soft spot for the island nations because,
yeah.
Again, promises were broken with them with Super Rugby. The amount of times they were promised a team in Super Rugby and then it never eventuated. And they've seen, you know, Japan get a team in there ahead of them, Argentina get a team in there ahead of them. And you do wonder, had you actually gone with the Pacific Islanders, you might have had a more viable league. Okay, you might have had to sustain it, but you would have got viewers watching in those islands. You would have had strong rugby support. You would have had a much tougher competition, probably. And
you'd have had more outsiders following them because a lot of people actually love the idea of watching those nations play because they play attractive rugby. And even when you see Tonga's playing, you know, England during the World Cup... In the back of your head, you know, England's probably going to win this game. But you'll watch Tonga play because you love watching Tongans play rugby. Or you love watching Samoans or Fijians. And let's face it, they play really attractive rugby. I love watching the Islanders go about it.
Yeah, I mean, I never forget the World Cup here. What was it? 2003, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And England were based in Perth in Western Australia. Samoa were here. And Samoa had an injury. And England had an injury as well. They flew out business class, a backup scrum half. But the Samoans, four players, were not released by their clubs in England to be able to play in the World Cup.
Yeah.
They were told if they went back, their contracts would be ripped up. Now, again, that was a disparity that I believe has now been sorted out and they must be released by their clubs. But again, there's been always this hampering those nations because they could challenge one of the dominant nations if they were given the game time and the opportunity. And it's being given those opportunities.
Yeah, I'm glad that situation's been sorted out because that's disgraceful, really. To hold a player back from representing their nation. And is it because you know that once they come back from that World Cup, they're going to be able to say, well, you can add another zero on that contract. Thanks. I'm an international rugby player. You know, there's all sorts of shady shenanigans that go on.
But we've seen that even with Super Rugby. I mean, if you take a player like Lottie Takiri, in that he had to turn his back. I think he's Fijian, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he had to turn his... He played rugby league for Fiji, but was told if he wanted to play Super Rugby, he had to swear allegiance to Australia. And you just go, I don't think that's right. And again, you know, look, but we've gone off the track because does the world rankings points mean anything in team sports?
It's interesting in, say, in hockey's case where the top ranked teams seem to be right. When you get to tournaments, you generally get the top four or five always turning up in the semi-finals, and it's hard for teams underneath that to break through into that top four or five. I mean, at the moment it's Australia, Belgium, Netherlands, And then there's a little bit of a gap. Argentina are close, but there is a little gap. Once you get below that, those teams are all in another bracket of abilities and skills. So, you know, how you, I think it's at the
you
top
could say
they get
the
it
same
right.
with football,
yeah,
to be honest.
At the very top, they get it right. Probably the top 10 is about right. But once you get below that, because of the disparity that exists with the number of games played and the points available at different tournaments, that's where it becomes very skewed. And you will get a situation where a European team who's playing top against top class opponents will be ranked lower than a team that isn't playing such top class opponents. And that's a disparity that doesn't get talked about a lot often. We're always talking about the disparity for teams who are playing in these other games, but there's also a disparity for the teams that are in tough competitions that are probably better than some of these other teams, but they're ranked lower because they're playing tougher competition all the time. So where do you draw the line? What, maybe you're right. Maybe you just get rid of world rankings, and if you've got a proper World Cup and Olympic qualifier, separate qualifiers, but properly set up where there's equal opportunity for everybody, then that sorts out rankings, and you go, right, we've had the World Cup. Netherlands won, they're ranked number one. Australia came second, they're two. And through the World Cup qualifying, you can figure out, oh, that nation came 52nd because that's what their results say they came. They're 50 bloody second.
Yeah, I mean, the question I throw up is, are the world rankings there purely so that these sports can get funding from their governments? Because it looks great if they're ranked there. Whereas if you go with the model that you've got, to me, that would actually be fairer. It's fairer in both sides, but you can see that if you're ranked 52nd, you may have aspirations to get to number 20, but then surely you've got to find the money to get the games, to get the practice matches, etc.
And that's a problem that's going to be inherent with whichever system you have. I think that it's that says more about the reliance that sports may have on government money
I think is too much these days.
Absolutely it is. And say in hockey's case, we have to rely on it because the sport has for so long ignored the fact that we have to move into a professional era. I mean, rugby went 95, went truly professional, even though it was sort of
95 was the last amateur World Cup.
Yeah, but they're still struggling with the issues transitioning from amateur to professional sport. And hockey's so far behind that. The administrators still haven't got it through their head that trying to suck up government money to support the sport is not the way forward. In fact, it's the way to go backwards. And money's tight. Money will only become tighter.
Well, even if you look at football in this country, I mean, and we're talking soccer, as you like to call it. I mean, the amount of money that the government has thrown at that, and I mean, the FFA came into being 2005, I think it was. And so that's 14 years, and yet they're still putting their hand out for money from the government, and the government is supporting their bids for events, etc.
And this is a professional sport. Okay?
Yeah, exactly. And some of the average
pay players multi-millions of dollars worth of money. Now, if Neymar dropped 1 week's wage, WA could have a home of football. That's how ludicrous that economy is.
But also you look at the A-League, and I think the average wage a year ago was around 100,000 to 110,000 for an A-League player. And you're going, okay, that's a pretty good wage for a sport that you're only playing 6 months of the year. Because the season runs pretty much from sort of October and is over by March. Okay, there's pre-season training and stuff like that, but that's a good salary when you think of the amount of matches you're actually playing in a year. And I just question again, if you're not playing enough games, you're not generating enough revenue, which therefore means you have to keep going to the government. So we talked about obviously some of the changes that the A-League owners are looking at. Yeah. To me, one of the things they've got to look at is making the league in line with leagues around the world where they're playing for 9 months of the year. Then hopefully by that stage, they will be totally self-funding and they won't need to keep asking for the government to give them a help.
Have they got their season wrong?
That's a hard one because, I mean, obviously, the old NSL used to try and go head-to-head with the AFL. And it struggled to get airtime, it struggled to get media coverage, etc. So then it went for the decision to play in the summer leagues. I think the thing that they've got horribly wrong since it got to the A-League is, like most sports fans, people are traditionists. They like to go to the pub or they like to go to a restaurant before a game. And the reason the Glory was a success in the first years when Nick Turner and Paul Afcos owned it was everybody knew that the kickoff times were the same time on a Sunday, and you had a routine and you could plan your weekend around it. And I think the thing that's made it very hard for not just Perth Glory but other clubs around the country is having differing kickoff times and differing kickoff days. So, you know, sometimes you've got a Friday night game, and we've seen it here in Perth. Sometimes the Friday night games have been 7 or 7.30. Then other there was one that was 5 o'clock when we were doing it. We were broadcasting the games back on 9.90. And, I mean, it was crazy. There was nobody in the ground, and the traffic was all jam-packed because people were trying to get from work to NIB Stadium, as it was then, and they just couldn't do it. So I think the kickoff times and the days that teams play has a big bearing on those issues.
And a lot of those... A lot of it, that's brought about by broadcasters too. It's broadcasters saying, we want a game here, and you've got to give it to us because we paid you a lot of money.
Well, that throws out the question, do you need to see the games live? Like, I'll be honest, if I was the owner of Perth Glory, I would say that we want our time games to be played at this time. If that means only half of them are going to be broadcast live, I'll take that. Because more people hopefully come if it's not live on TV. And then I would say, you can show it on delay. No problem. Because I'd rather have the people come through the gate than sitting at home watching it on the TV.
Well, when you think about the current management model of the A-League, well, owners would do that because they're not getting the revenue shared to them by the FA.
Well, they are actually. They all get a fair chunk of it.
Okay, so, but you know, it's memberships and crowds that really drive the money for the owners. That's where they're, you know, food concessions and things like that, that's where they're going to make their money. It's not off the money, it's not out of the FFA, or yeah, it's not the FFA's pocket that's going to keep them involved in the sport and keep the club churning over. It's the monies they generate outside of that that's the real key to their success.
And the key thing is they've just got to pull fans back in.
Yeah, that's a long way from world rankings. I know one world ranking I'd like to see, one world ranking sheet. Sports podcast. I wonder where we rank on that on a global scale. Do you reckon we're going to the World Cup, mate? Podcasting.
I don't know about that, but I am going to throw down a challenge just before we finish.
Yep.
In that I wrote a piece about how board members at the FIH are chewing up a lot of money flying business class to meetings. I'm going to throw down a challenge to the first board member to actually come out publicly and say that they will not be flying business class at the moment, so that that money can be reinvested into the game so teams can actually attend international tournaments. The first one to do that, I'll take my hat off to them, but I'm waiting for it.
Well,
waiting.
I'll double down on your challenge and say, I'll challenge the first FIH board member to come out and say that they're going economy and actually doing it.
That's true. Well, in fact, as someone said to me, and I still believe this, why they can't do a meeting over the internet now. I don't know why they actually have to fly all the way to Switzerland, but anyway, that's another thing. That would save a lot of money if they actually didn't fly.
The best idea for a sport is to base yourself in the third most expensive city in the world and make everybody fly there. Come on, Ashley.
Some people are on the fence. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.